Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking with the authors of Democracies and Dictatorships in Latin America, Emergence, Survival, and Fall. The book is published this year by Cambridge University Press. I hope that you enjoy this interview. Welcome back to the podcast. Again, my name is Heath Brown, and I have the real pleasure to be talking today with Scott Manwaring, who is the author of Democracies and Dictatorships in Latin America. Scott, how are you doing today?
Doing great. How are you, Heath?
I'm doing great. We had a rainy day in New York, but it's a real great book to read, and I've been excited to talk to you about the book. We've been a long-awaited conversation. Before we get to our conversation about the book, maybe you could introduce yourself and also your co-author who wasn't able to join us today on the call.
Right. Well, I've taught political science at Notre Dame for 32 years, and I've loved being here. I've had great colleagues and some wonderful graduate students and undergraduates. One of my best graduate students, without doubt, was Aníbal Pérez Liñán, my co-author. We began writing together his first year in graduate school. He's gone on to have just an excellent career at the University of Pittsburgh. He's a tenured associate up for full professor this year. So we had a great time working on this project together.
You know, and the result is just so interesting. I have a developing theory that you can judge the quality of the book by the length of the acknowledgement section of the book. And you have a long one. So I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit more about how this book came about. What's its history?
Well, the ancient history of it is that I was thinking, you know, this is the mid-90s, thinking about the remarkable, unexpected democratization progress in Latin America. That is, you know, many, many scholars and policy analysts and politicians had always said, you know, democracy in Latin America goes through these cycles, and especially in circumstances in which economic performance is really bad, social outcomes are bad, you know, these regimes aren't going to last. Economic performance in many cases was terrible. Social outcomes were terrible. And yet these regimes lasted. They weren't, you know, vibrant, dynamic, extraordinary democracies in all cases, but in almost all cases, they survived. So that was, in a way, that framed the thinking for the book. You know, what explains why democracies and dictatorships emerge and then survive or break down? Initially, my initial question was focused very much on what is it about the third wave of democratization in Latin America that's so very different that regimes have survived despite at that time really bad economic and social performance. But this quickly, you know, over time, it led to a more ambitious book to think about the longer term in Latin America from really 1900 to 2010, and also to engage more deeply a panoply of theories about democratization and authoritarianism.
You know, and you seek out some pretty big explanations for regime change. This is it might not be the longest book, but it's a big book in terms of its ambitions, and you take on some well known theories on similar dynamics. I wonder what some of the problems were that you saw in the existing approaches to regime change and some of the issues that you take on in the book.
Sure. Well, modernization theory did not seem particularly promising to explain regime change and stability in Latin America, because from earlier work of ours and others, empirically it just didn't pan out. Some of the recent class theories of democratization were also empirically very questionable for Latin America. So if you posit that workers will support democracy whenever it's feasible, and otherwise might strive for revolution, in the Latin American context, there are too many cases in which workers supported left of center populist and authoritarian regimes and actually worked against democracies. The cultural theories of Ronald Engelhardt, all these are important, you know, very engaging theoretical approaches by excellent scholars. But in that case, you know, Engelhardt's work, the biggest question mark that you had to ask is, so, you know, in Latin America, if you ask the question of citizens, is democracy always the best form of government? Well into the 2000s, in a lot of countries with stable democracies, you know, 40 or even 50% of respondents said, no, it isn't always the best form of government. So there was a mismatch between the theoretical expectation that you would have stable democracy when citizens are solidly supportive, and the reality in Latin America, which was that you had, in most countries, stable competitive regimes without such strong citizen unequivocal support for democracy.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about the book is you both seek out these theoretical explanations, but you also give really good explanations for why you're doing it. And this is sort of in some ways not the focus of the book, but your explanations for why theory development and why your approach is grounded is really important. You offer both a macro and a micro approach. I wonder what this perspective allows you to do in the book, to take both the macro and the micro together.
Right. Well, I mean, of course, you know, the micro and the macro are integrated. And so at the macro level, we think about country outcomes and regional outcomes as the variables that we're trying to explain. But at the micro level, we think about actors as being an indispensable unit of analysis. So what we mean by actors, you know, are either presidents or organized actors such as parties, social movements, armies, guerrilla groups, and so forth. You know, you just can't predict macro level outcomes based mostly or exclusively on structural variables. You have to look at actors' preferences and their actions on the ground. So we really built up from actors and their preferences at a first level of analysis to country outcomes at a second, and then we connect country outcomes to regional waves at a third level.
Now, why don't you tell us a little bit about the data? Because there's some pieces of it that are newly collected and offer some leverage points for you. So what are the kinds of data that you used for this?
Right. So again, beginning from the micro level, we collected data for 20 Latin American countries, all 20, from 1945, or actually 44 to 2010. And so we sliced each country into presidential periods. For the 20 countries, there were 290 presidential periods. And then if you think that actors make history, they do so, you know, they're not free will actors, they're in specific international structural and cultural contexts. But we thought it was really important to understand the logic of each of these actors. So we had a research team identify, you know, who are the most important actors in each of these presidential periods. Typically the research team, following our very detailed instructions, identified around from 3 to 7 actors for each presidential period. So that ended up generating a total of 1,460 actors for the 290 presidential periods. So then what is the charge for each of these members of the research team? We asked them to code three variables for each actor in each presidential period. The first variable is what we call normative preferences for democracy and normative preferences for dictatorship. The idea of these variables is that actors often, maybe some would say usually, are very instrumental in their attitudes about political regimes. Will support a regime if it gives them good outcomes. But we think that it's also the case that some actors have what we call normative preferences about political regimes. Some, you know, really good economists working at the individual level have developed the concept of procedural preferences and instrumental preferences. For us, a normative preference for democracy is an actor who has a procedural preference for democracy. They prefer democracy because of its guarantees, the guarantees of civil and political rights, the guarantee of elections, which mean that you can, you know, if you don't like the government, you have an opportunity to change it. And what is a normative preference for dictatorship? In some contexts, for example, one could think about Iran today, right? There are very powerful actors who think that a theocracy is the best possible form of regime, even if it doesn't produce good economic outcomes, for example. And then the third variable was a scale for each actor from moderation to radicalism. And that's a scale that sounds familiar. It's we use it to combine two things. One is where actors are in a left-right scale. To be a radical actor, you can't be in the center for us. You don't have to be far left or far right. And you have to combine that position on the left-right scale with what we call policy impatience or intransigence. So, in other words, you could be a left Democrat, but if you're willing to say, okay, you know, I want profound social change, but I think it's essential to do it through a democratic process, and I'm willing to accept slow change if to protect democracy. For us, that is not a radical actor. In some other definitions, of course, it would be.
And why don't you tell us just a little bit? There's lots and lots of findings, and I want to talk, after we talk about this, I'd like to talk about a little bit about the case studies. But I wonder if you can just describe a little bit about what your statistical analysis showed us.
Well, the main variables that show up in the statistical analysis, first, international influences, the regional political context is important for both democratic stability and transitions to democracy. Second, the normative preferences for democracy variable is very important for explaining why democracies persist. And third, this is interesting, and it wasn't ex ante obvious. Radicalism is problematic for democracy. That is, high radicalism predicts democratic lower probability of democratic survival. That variable had no impact on dictatorships. We think that the reason is that radical actors can be very good at challenging dictatorships in some contexts. In other contexts, radical actors spur a dictatorship on to dig its heels in even more firmly. So we think that's where we get a wash with that variable.
And I wonder if we could turn to the two case studies of Salvador and Argentina. How did these statistical findings bear out with your qualitative look at these two specific nations?
Good. So in Argentina, both the radicalism and the normative preferences for democracy variables play out exactly in accord with the quantitative findings. In the Salvadoran case, it's slightly trickier. You know, if you code El Salvador as semi-democratic from 1984 on, as we do. There you have a case in which, despite actors that a predominance of actors with weak normative preferences and very radical actors, a semi-democratic regime was able to survive. But if you look attentively, you know, it's also the case that these actors pretty quickly, that is by, you know, the late 80s, became much less radical. The most important actors, the FMLN and ARENA, the right-wing political party, both moved away from their previous normative preferences for some kind of dictatorship to at least neutral initially. And then we think that, you know, they had a soft normative, they developed a soft normative preference for democracy. The international variable, we think, was less important in the Argentine case. Not surprisingly, Argentina is a pretty big country, pretty far from the United States. Where the international variable was important in Argentina was that it was, Argentina was part of a southern cone and Brazil and beyond rethinking of politics on the left. The Salvadoran case, you know, I think was very significantly influenced by U.S. policy. So the international variable was really important in that case.
How bound are these findings, either the qualitative or the quantitative, how bound are they to Latin America? Asking you to sort of do what you didn't try to do, but how generalizable can we take these findings to other settings?
Right. I think that they work very well for a lot of European cases in the 20th century. So we very briefly in the book discuss Weimar Germany, the Spanish Civil War, the breakdown of democracy in Spain in 1936, and then the reconstruction of democracy, the transition to democracy and the consolidation of democracy in Spain from 1977 on. But I think, you know, beyond that, it works really well for most of Europe and most of the 20th century. I don't know enough, say, about the Arab world or, you know, a lot of other parts of the world to be able to say, yeah, I'm really confident that this theoretical approach would work beyond the Western world. Anibal and I don't entirely agree about how much it works for earlier time periods. I think of this, our theoretical approach, as working mostly at a time of mass politics. It's at this period of time when, you know, organized actors become really important. Before then, often more personalistic domination was the way that authoritarian rule happened. Of course, there's some of that well into the 20th century, but it coexists with very important organizations. So I think of our theoretical approach as mostly, you know, 20th century, or in some countries, many countries in Europe and Latin America, late 19th or perhaps even mid 19th century, but not for earlier time periods.
So the book is out, and it's really interesting. What's next for you? Are you guys going to be working together on something? Is there something that we can have to look forward to?
Well, we are working on a couple of papers together. One on democratic erosions, which we define as either a movement from democracy to semi-democracy, or from semi-democracy or democracy to authoritarianism, but without a coup. So that paper will build on the same data set, and we'll see what we come up with.
We have that to look forward to, as well as the current book, which is Democracies and Dictatorships in Latin America, Emergence, Survival, and Fall. The book was published in 2013 by Cambridge University Press, available widely. Scott, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Heath. Great questions. I enjoyed the interview.